Welcome to Bahar Bechukosai. And the truth is that, like, I was thinking that for this shiur I would probably just take something from Shemitah, because I've given shiurim on Shemitah. We've been learning Shemitah, actually, in our Beit Midrash this year, and next year is a Shemitah year. But then I remembered that there's something that I wanted to look at and discuss at the end of Parshas Bahar. And usually, because there are so many big things in the beginning of Bahar, there's Shemitah, and there's Yovel, and there's all sorts of other very interesting halachic issues that come up in the beginning, it gets missed. And that is the law of bowing on a stone floor. And that's what I want to talk about. As I think I put in my email, I'm not sure, but I want to dedicate learning this morning in memory of those who died in Meron, and for Refuah Shlema, for those who are still in need of that. So I'm going to start with a question, just a quick survey. We have people here who daven in different shuls, and who have davened in different shuls before, lived in different places. Is it your observation that women do or do not bow on Yom Kippur, like on the floor on Yom Kippur, whether in Aleinu or whether in the Avoda in Musaf? But in you've seen that women actually do, like, you know, on the floor. I'm not talking about
on the floor all the way down. Yes.
Got it.
So growing up in Tiffany Torah, they didn't.
Yeah.
So when I was growing up in Tiffany Torah, where I grew up, but at the Bayou now in the United States.
Interesting.
So I'm at Kolel of Raisim of Toronto, women did not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they would anyway ever move in that direction because of tzniyas.
Mm-hmm. Goldie, sorry.
So the shul where I grew up in Vienna, which is sounds like Kolel of Reichim, is actually, they didn't used to, but then I feel like about 15 years ago there was a shift and the younger generation started to, and more people do.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And Liba, you were going to say?
I also think when I was growing up, it was like a few that did, and now I think it's more mixed, but more leaning towards the side that people do in the Minyano I've been davening at for the past few years.
It's very interesting. I have no clue.
I know. I don't know. Some people have the mats also. It's a whole
system. Well, we're going to get to the mats. The mats is where I'm going with this. But I wanted to first know if you bowed, because otherwise the mats are not relevant.
Everywhere, so that she could put her hand down on the tissue.
So I've heard that some do and some don't. I actually did a search last night online just to see, and found an I'm a Mother forum where they you had all over the place. You know, they do, they don't. Some do, Hasidim don't. Whatever it was. There is an idea which is brought in the name of Rav Soloveitchik. I also saw it in the Tshuvos van Hagos, that women don't do it, not because of a concern of tznius, but rather because of what it is meant to memorialize. Meaning the idea of bowing down to the floor on Yom Kippur is because the Kohen Gadol would say the name of Hashem, and everybody who was in the Azara, the main outer room in the Beis HaMikdash, would then bow down to the floor. Women were not in the Azara. They were in the Azrat Nashim, which is outside of that. And therefore, they didn't have that bowing down to the floor. And that would be a halachic reason why it wouldn't be relevant for them to do so. But certainly, you know, I grew up doing it. There's some debate as to doing it on Rosh Hashanah in Aleinu or just on Yom Kippur in Aleinu, but certainly doing it for the Avoda in Aleinu on Yom Kippur. And because of that, I'm familiar with the practice, which some of you have just mentioned, about putting a separation between yourself and the floor. Now, I heard someone mention hands for a separation. I haven't seen that. I've seen people put something between their forehead and the floor, and I've seen people put something between their knees and the floor. So the knees part, I've seen articles about this. It's not so clear that you need to have anything between your knees and the floor, but it's really about the forehead, and that's where we're going to go in this shiur. The source for putting those things out, the napkins, the cloth, there was a tzedakah, which sent out a korim cloth. That you could put out with Vanachnu Korimu Mishtachavim, you know, on it. That was interesting. I had that until I lost it at some point a couple of years ago. But it comes from the end of Parshas Bahar, and we're going to see a few different explanations of what it's about, including Rashi, who takes it in what I think is an unusual direction with lessons for us. So, if you have the source sheet, you have it, because I sent out the email the second time with the source sheet. Hopefully you have that. From the end of Bahar. Lo sa'asu lachem elilim. Don't make idols for yourselves. Ufesel umatzeva lo sakimu lachem. Don't set up statues, monuments. Ve'eben maskis lo sitnu ba'artzechem. And I just pulled the Koran translation. I didn't have time to write my own. So they translate Eben Maskis as a figured stone, a shaped stone. Don't put that out in your lands. Lishtachavos aleha, to bow down upon it. Ki ani Hashem Elokechem, because I am Hashem, your God. So you can't put out Eben Maskis, which again they translate as a figured stone. We're going to come back to that. In your land, to bow on it. And then it goes on to say, guard my Shabbos, revere my Mikdash, I am Hashem, and then you get the opening pasuk in Bechukosai, if you follow my mitzvos, then things will be wonderful, and if you don't, then you get the Tochacha. That's the immediate text. We're going to broaden the context shortly to see what comes before this, but that's what the Pesukim say. So, immediately, you have to ask a question. The opening two sentences there, the last two in Parshas Bahar, okay? Don't make idols. Don't put out a stone floor or figured stone in order to bow on it. Guard my Shabbos. Revere my Mikdash. Where is the link between the first part, idolatry and bowing on a stone floor, and the second part, guard my Shabbos, revere my Mikdash? What's the connection? It's hard. Like, what? I don't know. It's very strange. So first of all, not everybody believes that Shabbos and Mikdash in that sentence actually refers to Shabbos and the Beis HaMikdash. Ibn Ezra quotes a view, it's not his own, it's found in the Targum Yerushalmi on this pasuk, that Shabbos here is actually a reference to Shemitah. And Mikdash here is a reference to Yovel. And the reason that will help is because earlier in the Parsha we talked about Shemitah and Yovel. So this would refer back to the beginning of the Parsha. At least it gives it some connection, even if the connection to Avodah Zarah is not so clear. We can explain the connection to Avodah Zarah shortly. That's one approach. However, it's not so clear at all. I mean, Shabbos being Shemitah, I can understand. We call Shemitah Shabbos. Like, that happens. Yovel being Mikdash is a harder fit. So generally speaking, the way that that we understand it is through source number two. It goes back to the immediately preceding section in the Parsha, which talks about being an Eved. And I brought you just the beginning and end of that section. I didn't bring you all the Psukim. Where, in source number two, V'chisa sig yad ger... Wow, where did everybody just go? Is that my connection? No, it's not my connection. Okay. V'chisa sig yad ger v'soshav imach, umach achicha imo. if you have a situation in which, on the one hand, there is an outsider, as he's put, or they call it a sojourner here, somebody who becomes wealthy, at the same time that a Jew becomes poor and indebted, and he is sold off to the Ger Toshav, he is sold off to somebody as an Eved, then the rule is, you should redeem him. Buy him out of whatever debt slavery he has ended up in. Debt slavery is not a halachic institution. We don't have a concept of avdus for paying off debts. That's a longer discussion. And this section concludes, Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim avadayim. You are supposed to be Hashem's avadim. You are not supposed to be avadim of human beings. I took you out of Egypt. I am Hashem, your God. And that's what leads into this passage about idolatry. So that what's going on here is, and this you see from Rav Yosef Bechor Shor. I brought it for you in source number 3. He says, Shelo timkor atzmecha legoy, shehu yitzav elecha lasos malacha b'shabbos. If you sell yourself off to a non-Jew, you can end up in a situation where he tells you to violate Shabbos. So don't sell yourself as an Eved because you're supposed to be an Eved to Hashem. That's the Shabbos reference. Umikdashi tira'u, and revere my mikdash, isn't about the Beis HaMikdash, but it's about Hashem's Kedusha. Kedusha si tira'u velo simkor atzmecha legoy shetechal al shem shamayim. You have to revere the Kedusha of Hashem, the holiness of Hashem. Don't sell yourself off such that you will desecrate the name of God by having to do all sorts of terrible things. Because what could happen is this person who serves Avodah Zarah may make the Jew who's serving him do it as well. Right? If you think of the story in Tanakh of Naaman, who is a general for a non-Jewish king, he ends up having to help the non-Jewish king serve Avodah Zarah, as the Gemara discusses, the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So what this text is telling me is, don't let a Jew be sold into slavery. You could end up in a position in which he ends up having to violate Shabbos, having to violate Hashem's holiness. So you don't want that, and that's what we are, and that's the link to serving idols. And then it mentions all these other, you know, these other idolatrous things. The Netziv in the Hamek Davar has a similar idea. So does Rav Avadya Sforno have an idea. Rav Avadya Sforno makes it broader. He says if you're going to be in exile, you have to make sure to guard Hashem's Kedusha and to guard Shabbos. So what you could do is read the section backward. Meaning, I'm just trying to explain the psukim. We'll get back to bowing on the floor and interrupting between the floor and you, but I just want to explain the psukim themselves. What is this mitzvah about? We talked about being a slave to a non-Jew, and we're warning you, don't, if you're going to do that, you're going to get stuck into idolatry, you're going to have Shabbos problems. Don't do it, because you're supposed to serve Hashem. That's one way to understand the flow of the text, the flow of the psukim. Clear? So as we said before the internet went out, the point here, what we're trying to say, is that this section that we're talking about belongs with what came before it. Don't create a situation in which a Jew is working for a non-Jew. They could end up having to worship idols. They could end up having to violate Shabbos. And that's one way to understand the section. The other way to understand the section is that it connects forward in the text. Meaning, the thing that follows this is, if you follow my mitzvos, then things will be good for you. And if you take a look at source number 4, that leads you to the pasuk in which we're told, I am Hashem your God who took you out of Egypt, mihyos lehem avadim, so that you would not be slaves to them. So as long as you guard my Shabbos, as long as you guard my sanctuary, then you won't be avadim, you won't have to sell yourself as an Eved. Okay. Either way, your basic message is the importance of Avodah Zarah, the importance of Shabbos, and that's your overall, preventing slavery, or when a person is a slave. But that's just, again, context, understanding the psukim. That doesn't help us with our question about putting something between you and the floor and what we're supposed to learn from it. If you take a look at source number 5, you get the statement of the Rama where he brings this as halacha, the business of covering the floor. He says, Asur l'chol adam lipol apanav v'pishut yadayim v'raglayim. Afilo ein sham even maskit. He says, you're not allowed to fall forward before God, stretching out fully on the ground, even if there is no even maskit, even if there is no stone floor. However, you incline partially on your side and you're okay, and now I'm bringing this as the Mishnah Brura explains it, because there's actually, yeah, there are some issues in the text in the Ramah, but I brought the Mishnah Brura's explanation as part of my translation. If one inclines partially on his side, you're permitted to stretch out, or if there is no stone floor. In other words, what we're saying is you can stretch out if you're not on a stone floor, and he says that's what's done on Yom Kippur. What do you mean? When you bow to the floor on Yom Kippur, spread grass on the floor. They didn't use paper napkins. They spread grass on the floor to interrupt between the floor and yourself. And he says that is the practice. So what the Rama tells us, as explained in the Mishnah Brura, is that you want to have an interruption between the floor and yourself. And I add to that, even though, I daven in a shul that has a carpet, there isn't, I'm not bowing on a stone floor. Nonetheless, the practice is to do it even if there's a covering on the floor. Okay. So all we've accomplished right now is understanding the psukim in context and understanding that there is this issue of not bowing on a stone floor or figured stone as the Koran translated. So now let's
can
get.
I just,
yeah.
Sorry. Can I just, how come, or why is it better a natural floor as opposed to a stone floor? Is that because a stone is connected to a mizbeach, or?
So this is where we're going right now. Hang in there, because we're going to have three approaches. But that's exactly what I wanted to get to. The Rambam, in source number 6, offers us one approach, and it's sort of traditional Rambam. Many, many mitzvos in the Torah, the Rambam says, are about distancing ourselves from what idolaters do. And idolaters bow on a stone floor. Take a look. He says, Ze gam kein, in number 6. He says, this too is prohibited, lest it appear like idol worship. For so they would make decorated stone with sophisticated craft before the statue, and upon it they would bow to the statue. This was a popular thing. He is taking that even maskit, which the Koran translated as figured stone. He's saying it's some kind of ornate type of a setup, and we don't want to look like that. We don't want to look like what the idolaters do when they bow, so therefore we're not going to bow on a stone floor. In the same way that when the Torah says that you're not supposed to get a certain kind of a haircut, right? Lo sakifu pa'as roshchem, not to cut the hair straight around. He says that's because that was a practice of their idolaters. The priests for idolatry used to do it, therefore we don't do it. We don't want to look like that. Now, we did have a stone floor in the Beis HaMikdash. People bowed on a stone floor in the Beis HaMikdash, and that becomes a bit of a discussion. But, that goes into a very interesting other issue of, do we change the things that we do if they become idolatrous practices? But we're not going there right now. But that's the Rambam's explanation. They bow on stone floors before their idols. We can't bow before stone floor, bow on a floor before God, on a stone floor before God. The Sefer HaChinuch notes that, but adds a second approach. If you take a look at source number 7, Hebrews bottom of one side, English top of the next side, he says, it is also possible that the reason is lest one appear to bow to the stone itself. Again, even maskit, it's this ornamental type of setup. It's something that's supposed to be artistic. So the concern is that the stone itself appears to be what you are bowing to. Since they prepare and design it, and it is attractive, there is room for suspicion. As opposed to, if it's some kind of beged, it's some kind of fabric, he says, nah, then we're not concerned, because fabric is quickly destroyed, the stone endures, stone has certain elements that make it more likely to be associated with worship. That's the position of the Sefer HaChinuch. So I have two explanations. One, don't look like you're worshiping idols, because idolaters bow on stone floors. Number two, you don't want people to think you're bowing to the stone itself. Okay, those are the standard explanations. You walk up to a random person in shul and ask them, why is it that we're putting stuff between ourselves and the floor? That's the explanation that they're going to give you. However, Rashi gives an entirely different approach, which I think teaches us an important lesson. Take a look at source number 8. Rashi, on this pasuk of Lihishtachavot Aleha, to bow upon it, he says, even to heaven, don't set up a stone floor on which to bow, even if you're bowing to worship Hashem, because bowing is with extended arms and legs, that's what we're talking about, fully spread out, and the Torah prohibited this outside the Beis HaMikdash. Nothing to do with worshiping idols. You're not allowed to do it outside the Beis HaMikdash. No going straight out on the floor outside the Beis HaMikdash. Where in the world did this come from? If you take a look at source number 9, Rashi says it as well in the Gemara and Megillah. The Gemara and Megillah records that Rav, major sage, end of the period of the Mishnah, beginning of the period of the Gemara, did not bow on a stone floor. He wouldn't do it. So Rashi here says, the Torah did not prohibit, that's the wording in the Gemara, lo asra Torah, the Torah did not prohibit in this verse, other than to make a floor of stone in a synagogue, like that of the Beis HaMikdash. Like that of the Beis HaMikdash. The issue is, it can't emulate the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash has a stone floor. We are not supposed to make our shuls with a floor on which to bow, like they do in the Beis HaMikdash. That doesn't mean I can't have a stone floor in a shul. It means that I can't bow on it. Where did Rashi get this idea? It's about not emulating the Beis HaMikdash? Isn't that a little bit odd? I mean, we do emulate the Beis HaMikdash, right? We call our shul a Mikdash Ma'at, a mini sanctuary. We have certain rules and certain mitzvos, which are about emulating the Beis HaMikdash. How do we understand this?
We kept up. Right, that's the one difference, in a Beis HaMikdash, there was you did bring sacrifices, which that's the one thing we can't do.
Mm-hmm.
So I
missed the beginning of what you were saying, because my internet went bad for a moment. So you're saying that we can't... I missed the beginning, and I think I, as a result, I'm not understanding the end.
I'm just saying maybe the difference between our shuls and the Beit HaMikdash is that you can't bring a proper sacrifice in the shul.
Right.
So that difference should be kept up.
But
meaning, as much as we're trying to emulate the Beit HaMikdash, we should also highlight the differences between the places.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going
to say, why, if the Torah says not to do it, why did the Beit HaMikdash have it?
So let me just...
This pasuk is very...
Right. Just to answer Goldie first, I'm going to say something that I think is along the lines of where you're going. So hang in there on that idea. In terms of Chana's question about the Beis HaMikdash, having a stone floor, the only answer I can give you is the text in the Torah itself. If you go back to the beginning, where I brought it for you, it says Ve'even maskis lo sitnu be'artzechem. Don't put such a thing in your lands. So the Beis HaMikdash is not considered to be in your lands. The Beis HaMikdash is a separate site. That word is discussed in terms of the question of where exactly this law applies. the commentators pick up on it. But I think that would be why we would say Beis HaMikdash is okay. It's not Ba'artzechem. That would be my answer. So this idea of not emulating the Beis HaMikdash so closely is actually a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Take a look at source number 10, please. This must be where Rashi is getting it. The Torah says, Lo sa'asun iti Elohei chesed ve'Elohei zahav lo sa'asu lachem. Do not make with me gods of silver, gods of gold. That's what the Torah says. However, the Gemara stops the pasuk at Lo sa'asun iti. Don't make with me. It interrupts the middle of the sentence. Don't make with me. What does that mean? Don't make the images of the servants which serve before me. That which serves Hashem, you shall not make an image of. What does that mean? So the Gemara goes through different applications of this, but one of them is here, as is taught in a Braita. One may not make a house in the form of the Heichal. The Heichal is the large room in the Beis HaMikdash that housed, among other things, the Shulchan, the Menorah, the Kodesh Kadashim. You're not allowed to make a house in the form of the Heichal. You're not allowed to make a large room in the form of the Ulam, a yard in the form of the Azara. These are all areas in the Beis HaMikdash. You're not allowed to make a Shulchan that is modeled on the table that you used in the Beis HaMikdash, a Menorah in the form of the Menorah. You could have a menorah of 5 branches. You could have a menorah of 8 branches. You could have a menorah that's not made of metal, even if it's of 7 branches. But that's all that the Rambam is going to... I jumped down to the Rambam. Back in number 10, one may make a menorah of 5, 6, or 8 branches. In number 11, I just showed you the Rambam bringing this as halacha. It's also brought in the Shulchan Aruch in Yerodei Kuf Mem Aleph. So there is a halacha found in the Gemara that you're not supposed to make what you had in the Beis HaMikdash. Now, anyone who has been in Yerushalayim automatically has a question. Yes, Alina, what's the question?
So, funny, I was just about to search it up on Google, but isn't there the replica in the old city of what they built for the third Beit HaMikdash? And
yes.
It's exactly what you just explained here, so I'm wondering...
Yeah, you have Machon HaMikdash. They have all sorts of replicas. So what is that about? So there are two leniencies that are worth knowing about for this. Because it's not a halakha shir, I didn't bring the sources on it here, but there's a Chuvas Levushe Mordechai in Yoredeya Beis who says that, number one, this is considered to be rabbinic. Even though the Gemara in number 10 brings it from a pasuk, nonetheless, the Rambam believes that it is rabbinic and not biblical, and that's why the Rambam doesn't lump this in with other prohibitions which are biblical about what you're allowed to make and not allowed to make in the laws of Avodah Zarah. Instead, this is in the laws of the Beis HaMikdash, Shelchos Beis HaBechira. And he says that's why the Rambam is willing to accept a 7-branched menorah if it differs from the menorah in the Beis HaMikdash in fundamental ways. So this may be the answer to a question that I've had for years. My shul in Allentown had at the front, flanking the Aron, you had along the walls, sort of protruding from the wall, you had 7-branched menorot on either side, like sculpted from the wall. And I wondered about that. Why is that okay? Rabbi Karavkin was the rabbi before me, and he was okay with it. But it could be because it really doesn't resemble the one in the Beis HaMikdash because it's just something protruding from a wall. It's not a standalone thing. But that's one point for leniency, is it's rabbinic, and therefore if it doesn't fully resemble, maybe it's okay. The other, there's Rabbi Nechemia Taylor, who wrote an article in the journal Truman in 1984, it's volume 5, saying that if it's done in order to learn how these things should look, then it's okay. And that's their basis, is that it's done for the sake of study. We have that as a precedent in the Gemara for certain other issues about sculpting things, making images of things, and therefore they consider it acceptable. But the point for us is Rashi is not making up the idea that bowing on a stone floor is a problem because you are replicating what's in the Beis HaMikdash. It's a Gemara that you're not supposed to replicate it. But now I really want to push that question of where the line is. Take a look at source number 12, please, from the Rav Soloveitchik. This is something that was recorded by a student of his from a shir of his on Masechet Sukkah. And the Rav writes the following. It appears that there are two elements in memorializing the Mikdash. The Gemara talks about the importance of Zecher LeMikdash, remembering the Beis HaMikdash. We have two different aspects. One, the laws of mourning to remember the Mikdash. Grieving, right? What we call Zecher LeChurban, when we remember the destruction. It's a Gemara in Bava Basra. We say, Meshkachei Yerushalayim, you're not supposed to forget Jerusalem. So you have to remember Jerusalem as she was, and you mourn her ruin, as he puts it. The other is the law to remember the mitzvot connected with the Mikdash, meaning to set in our hearts the Mikdash as it will be when it is built speedily in our days. And this is our Talmudic passage on which he's commenting in the Gemara in Sukkah. We have a mitzvah of remembering the Beis HaMikdash. The foundation of these laws is from the verse, Tzion hi doresh ein la, she is Tzion, no one seeks her, from which the Gemara understands, you're supposed to seek Tzion. This is not mourning for the past, but fulfilling for the future when the Mikdash will be built. And from this, we have all sorts of halachos. One of them is a halacha that we're fulfilling right now, in this period of time on the calendar, counting the Omer. Right, we understand, there's a debate on this, but we understand that we count the Omer as a mitzvah of Zecher LeMikdash, to remember that they counted in the Beis HaMikdash from the second day of Pesach until the Karban on Shavuos. Our counting is a memorial to their counting. Another example of it, Hoshanos on Sukkos. We're commemorating a practice of the Nevi'im that goes back to the Beis HaMikdash. There are things that we do that are meant to commemorate what they did in the Beis HaMikdash. Not only that, I brought you a beautiful passage in source number 13. I love this passage so much. From Rabbi Levi Yitzhak Horowitz, the Bostoner Rebbe. When and how to mourn Judaism's many contradictions. He says, the same Jew who spends his midnight hours reciting Tikkun Chatzos in tearful memory of the destruction, nevertheless marches proudly and happily around the Bima in Shul with his Esrog and Lulav on Sukkos, in commemoration of Temple times. So he not only cries in remembrance of the Temple, he dances too. The same family that sits on the floor on Erev Tisha B'Av eating eggs and ashes, several months later sets a luxuriant table for its Pesach meal, and leaning in a kingly manner, eats matzah and maror wrapped together to remember how Hillel ate it in the time of the temple. Matzah and maror are not the only things wrapped together at the Seder. Our joy and our remembrance are intertwined too, not only in korech, but in the roasted egg and shank bone on the Seder plate, in the afikomen as well. All commemorations of what we had in the Beis HaMikdash that is no longer standing. His point being that remembering the Beis HaMikdash is not about grief. Remembering the Beis HaMikdash is also about celebration and remembering what we had that was wonderful. It's a beautiful thing. And so now I again put my question to Rashi, put my question to the Gemara and Avodah Zarah. We should dafka have a stone floor. And when we are, we should bow on a stone floor in order to remember what they had in the Beis HaMikdash. That's exactly what we ought to be doing. You see the problem. Clear? You understand the issue here. So, in order to try to answer this a little bit, I think we have to look at certain relationships that we have that are prescribed by the Torah. There are various cases in which we are told to be close to something, but not too close. Close to something, but not too close. And therefore, we get what you could think of as binary mitzvos. You have one mitzvah which is going to draw you close, and one mitzvah which is going to send you away. Can you think of, I don't know if I'm being clear enough, can you think of an example where we are told in the Torah you have one mitzvah to draw close to something, and then on the other hand, another mitzvah that tells you keep your distance? Two different mitzvos causing you to have two different relationships with something. This is a little vague. Let me give you an example.
Husband and wife?
Sorry?
Husband and wife?
What do you mean? Where do you have mitzvos that either draw close or make a separation? I mean, neither would be, I guess, at times a separation. Is that?
Yeah.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. But where's the parallel mitzvah that draws them close, or just general? Oh no, maybe. Right. That could be. That's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about it that way. I was going to start with God. The calling your spouse God may be an interesting thing, but but I was thinking about God. We have on the one hand a mitzvah of Ahavas Hashem, Ve'ahavta, right? You're supposed to love Hashem, and then on the other hand you have a mitzvah of Yiras Hashem. Right? Whether you call it fear, reverence, awe, it's clearly about distance. Hashem is described in the Torah as an esh ochla, consuming fire. Right? Moshe is as close as anyone can possibly ever be close to God. B'chol beisina emanhu, he is the one who is most faithful to God, loyal to God. He speaks to God pe el pe. And yet Hashem says to Mufanai lo yera'u, right? My face shall not be seen. There is a limit in the relationship. Close, but not too close. Or about parents, right? On the one hand, we have a mitzvah of kavod, to honor them, which has all sorts of actions of caring for them, which are intimate acts. They're close acts. You feed them, you clothe them. On the other hand, there is the mitzvah of mora, the mitzvah of, again, a form of reverence for them. Don't sit in their seat. Don't contradict them. All the different ways that you are told, remember their parents. You get too close. You become overly familiar. You step over a line that's inappropriate. Perhaps Shabbos could be put into this category as well. You have, on the one hand, the zachor elements of Shabbos, right? The things that you do that create honor for the day, give it special standing, so you prepare for it, and you bathe, and you put on nice clothing, and you prepare good food, and so on. And there's a certain sense of, like, ownership and access that comes with that. But then you have Shamor, all the different malachos that you're not allowed to engage in, remind you, this is a holy day. It's not really your property, so to speak. So I feel like we have mitzvos that push us and mitzvos that pull us. Mitzvos that will make us close to something or to someone, and mitzvos that will send us away. And I think the same thing is true for the Beis HaMikdash. We have an issue of Mora HaMikdash, of awe for the Beis HaMikdash. We need to take steps to ensure that we don't become overly familiar. And I think this is important because it's easy for us to lose that Mora, to lose that sense of reverence, with a sense of over-familiarity with God, to whom we daven every day. We need to find a way to feel close enough to Hashem that we're going to pour out our hearts when we daven, trusting Hashem is going to listen to us and hopefully, you know, respond positively. And yet we need to feel distant enough that we will be respectful when we approach God. Right? You need both. This plays out practically when we daven. We're taught that we have to treat a shul with special standing. Right? You're not allowed to use a shul as a shortcut to be able to go from one side of the room where you daven to the other side of the room where you daven. We're not allowed to engage in personal conversation when we're in shul. When we approach davening, we're supposed to wear special clothing. We have to have special kavana when we recite a bracha. There are times to sit. There are times to stand. It's very formalized. It's like you're not the one in control. You're not, you know, buddies with God. It's not, you know, it's not your private preserve. even as we want to feel so familiar that we're going to be comfortable, that we want to go there. I mean, think about the issue with little kids in shul. We want them to feel comfortable. And so people will give them candy. And so, you know, they'll bring their book or something to read. You know, you don't want them to hate being there or to feel unwanted. On the other hand, they have to have a sense, age appropriately, of the dignity of the space. You know, I mean, good luck. A 2-year-old, a 3-year-old doesn't have a sense of the dignity of the space. It has to be done in a way that's going to be right for them. But the message that we're getting in our parsha, as Rashi reads this, is that we dare not make our relationship with Hashem casual. Like the Gemara says, you don't import the Beis HaMikdash into your house. You don't set up a candelabra that looks like the menorah. You don't build a room with the dimensions and contours of the Beis HaMikdash. It's not your property. And as Rashi applies it to the stone floors, don't even import the Beis HaMikdash too closely into your shuls. You follow? I have to admit that I have one problem with this read of Rashi, and I didn't really look into it. It could be that somebody comments on it. And that is, there is no Beis HaMikdash at the time that this pasuk is stated. Rashi is reading this as being, don't emulate the Beis HaMikdash, which has a stone floor. We have no indication that the Mishkan had a stone floor. It would have made it very hard to transport. No one talks about transporting the floor of the Mishkan. So that there probably is a discussion of it that I just didn't see. It wasn't something that I thought about last night as I was working on this year. But it's, I think, a question worth noting. But coming back to the point here, keeping in mind the lesson that Rashi is trying to teach us, that the Gemara in Avodah Zarah is trying to teach us, is that the red lines are vital for us to retain that sense of kavod, that sense of honor. So to summarize this in the short Dvar Torah version, that as opposed to the, because I took it in a few different directions. What's wrong with bowing on a stone floor? Says the Rambam, resembling worshippers of Avodah Zarah who bow on stone floors. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, looks like you're bowing to the stone itself. Rashi, you're replicating the Beis HaMikdash. Just as we say in the Gemara, don't make a 7-branch menorah, don't make other entities that resemble the Beis HaMikdash, don't bow on a stone floor. To which I ask, but we're supposed to replicate the Beis HaMikdash. We have Zecher LaMikdash. We have the Hoshanos. We have counting the Omer. Yes, but we also have a boundary so that we don't become overly familiar. As in the relationship with our parents, where we have Kavod and Mora, maybe as we have the relationship with Shabbos, where we have Zachar and Shamor, if that fits this format. In the relationship that we have with Hashem, we always need to remember Hashem is not our grandparent. Hashem is not our best friend. Hashem is the Borei Olam. He's the creator of the universe, and that's something that we need to keep in mind. Okay? Well, thank you very much. And, maybe next week, should we do pre-Shavuos, or should we do a parsha? Sorry?